Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, July 28, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone will discuss the EPA and the states. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome today three experts for our call. We're going to hear opening remarks from each in turn of about 5 to 10 minutes, then maybe a little back and forth, but as always, we'll be turning to our audience for your questions, so please do be ready with your questions. We're going to hear first today from Chairman Dr. Brian W. Shaw. He's the Chairman of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. We're going to hear then from Mario Loyola. He's a senior fellow at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And finally, we'll hear opening remarks from Professor Michael S. Greva. He's at the George Mason University School of Law. But to get us started, Chairman Shaw, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I thank you for the opportunity to speak to this group. And on such an issue, it's one of what I consider to be one of the more pressing issues that we see, and one that frankly has a great potential for negative impact, not only on the economy and the well-being of our country, but some of the founding principles that we have that I know this group especially holds dearly to. In way of background, part of what the experience that I hope to share is our interactions that we've had in my time as the chairman of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, which has been for about the last 6 years, is EPA has seemed to clearly have no, they clearly do not seem to be bound by following and honoring the state's rights and the role that our founders envisioned. In fact, they seem to be very comfortable in rewriting federal law and unashamedly expecting to dictate the implementation that states put together for those federal regulations that they do develop. And it's gotten to the extent, it's not just coming from a state's perspective, but in one court decision where we were successful in having the courts overturn EPA's action on one of our permitting programs. One justice opined that EPA went to the point where they even wanted to dictate state sentence structure within their rules, and that sort of illustrates the shift that we've seen, where EPA seems to be much more comfortable not just having the state's rights respected, but instead dictating and mandating that states follow and implement their rules and their dictates exactly as they want. To give some example of that, which is probably the main reason that I've been asked to be on the phone, a couple of good examples, primarily leading from the desire of the current administration and current EPA to regulate greenhouse gases. As you recall, many of you who follow this issue, there was many failed attempts to have Congress pass laws to be able to allow EPA to dictate and the states to be required to regulate greenhouse gases. And after several of those failures, part of what the administration and the EPA seemed to set their mind on was that they were going to force states to comply with regulating greenhouse gases. They first sought to meet with states and encouraged us that it was in our best interest and that it made sense for us to regulate greenhouse gases, and it became even more clear as states such as ours, and myself included in those discussions, continue to point to flaws in the authority as well as the science and the role that EPA was mandating states follow, and it got to the point where they seem to fall onto the philosophy that's been prevalent in many of their actions, unfortunately, of late, and that is that if there's an outcome that they desire, deem it to be appropriate, acceptable, good, they seem unbound by even the federal laws and regulations that would mandate that, to the extent that I've even had officials tell me whenever I explained that our programs met federal rules and regulations and federal law, they indicated they weren't interested and didn't want that program to go forward, which again clearly illustrates that they've lost any commitment to following the law as written. And specifically what that then led to was back in the summer of 2010, EPA sent to each of the states a letter requiring that within a couple of months' time frame that each of those states they requested agree that they were going to allow EPA to dictate what greenhouse gas regulations would be, not just that you would do it, but how you would do that. for various reasons, that being one, something that was, I think, contrary to the Constitution and contrary to federal law, but also a really bad idea for how to develop environmental policy. We wrote back a letter that got some attention at the time that indicated, I think, fairly clearly that we had no intention, desire, and we were not going to allow EPA to force the state to rewrite our laws and force us to comply with their dictates on what greenhouse gas, how they ought to be handled in the state of Texas. And EPA, I think that really sort of set a new era in their creativity and willingness to really bend and break existing law and move forward, therefore, to implement and force us to regulate those greenhouse gases. Their first approach was to federalize that program, to develop a process where anyone who wanted to have a permit that met their desired criteria would then have to go through EPA under what was, I would somewhat say, manufactured pretext of their authority to get there. That led to untold delays, and in fact, very, very few permits have gone through the process. Effectively, EPA uses that tool to force states to be punished if they don't comply with EPA's request. And so the state of Texas legislature passed this last session, giving my agency the authority to issue those permits so long as they're required by federal law, effectively complying to some extent that we were going to try to find a way to issue permits and not let EPA continue to just slow down the process. But the point being that EPA has used that rule and used their authority that they perceive to have to circumvent congressional law as well as their own rules and regulations to force states to comply in a manner exactly as they dictate. They'll often use language such as that they're trying to provide a level playing field amongst the states, which I think whether on purpose or otherwise, it certainly circumvents the creativity, the innovation that the different states' rights and the different states have as laboratories for innovation to allow the free market to drive innovations. Gets thrown out the window, and we see that manifesting itself in this latest rule that EPA has moved forward with regard to greenhouse gas regulations, whereby they're attempting to regulate existing sources of electric generation, specifically coal, natural gas, and oil-fired power plants. But in this, you sort of see the result of this lack of concern for states' rights and state authority in that they group states arbitrarily. In one example, they deem that Texas can have an increase in our renewable energy portfolio for electric generation of 20%. And as you try to dig into how they get to that, it's sort of an arbitrary approach where they sort of deem that Kansas could get there. So Texas and I believe the five other states should be able to get to 20% of our generation capacity. And so it becomes very arbitrary, and the courts seem to be deferring to EPA and their arbitrary analysis more and more often, and EPA seems to be emboldened to be even more assertive with their rights, even above congressional oversight. And so I'd be happy to answer other questions that go along, but clearly from the environmental standpoint and from the state of Texas, we're seeing EPA and the administration continue to erode those states' rights that I think our founding fathers envisioned for us. So with those opening comments, I'd like to now turn it over to Mario Loyola, easy for me to say, Mario Loyola with Texas Public Policy Foundation to offer his comments.
Thank you, Chairman Shaw. Thank you very much, and thanks to all the participants on this call. I'm Mario Loyola, Senior Fellow at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and I just want to talk for a few minutes about the constitutional history, try to put the Texas experience with EPA sort of within the constitutional history of federalism here, dating back really to starting with the New Deal, which is sort of where the problem began, when the New Deal Supreme Court expanded the Commerce Clause out to the ends of the earth, and we discovered that there was a substantial overlap of state and federal regulatory authority over economic matters. One of the arguments that arose was to what extent could the federal government regulate the states as states. And I remember from law school, many of the people on this call might remember, that this was, I can't think of any area where the Supreme Court has reversed itself more often, reversing its very last pronouncement, starting with Maryland versus Wirtz in 1968, onto National League of Cities versus Usury, and then Garcia versus San Antonio. And the people who are concerned with the dual federalism, dual sovereignty of the states, We're very happy to see decisions such as New York versus United States in 1992 and Prince versus United States in 1997, when the Supreme Court said categorically that the federal government cannot force the states to regulate and cannot force state officials to do anything. Now, the problem with even those decisions, however, is that they allowed an enormous loophole, which was the permissive attitude that the Supreme Court has maintained all along towards cooperative federalism. It has insisted that cooperative federalism is okay because it's mere encouragement, not rising to the level of commandeering of state agencies or state officials. And so under the head of cooperative federalism, the Supreme Court has allowed the federal government to send billions of dollars every year to the states with all manner of conditions attached. And on the regulatory front, it's allowed programs like we see Texas locked in a battle with EPA over, in which Congress passes a regulation, EPA adopts a regulation, and then says, we will give the states permission to implement these regulations for us as long as they do so in the following fashion, specifying 150 conditions. And if they don't do it exactly the way that we spell out in these conditions, then we will come in and do it ourselves. So in the context of the Clean Air Act, states are required to propose a state implementation plan, or a SIP. And if the SIP is not compliant, if they're unable or unwilling to produce a compliant SIP, then the feds come in, EPA comes in with a federal implementation plan, or a FIP. And the Supreme Court has always said that these two main species of cooperative federalism are okay because it's mere encouragement. But in fact, we've long said, conservatives have long argued, that these programs contain a very strong element of coercion. We'll leave to aside for today the element of coercion that we've argued back and forth over in the spending context, South Dakota versus Dole, which appeared prominently in the Medicaid portion of the Obamacare ruling. For today, we're looking at the element of coercion in what lawyers somewhat confusingly call conditional preemption, which is an example of which is the SIB versus FIP process that we just described. Progressives have, progressives back to the New Deal, basically just shortly after the New Deal, have relied on a seminal article by Herbert Wexler in 1954 about the political protections of federalism. They've relied on that to argue that the political process, because states are represented in Congress, they've got plenty of protection from congressional encroachment, from federal encroachment on the dual federalism of the states. And the Supreme Court has taken refuge in that in order to, from Garcia, this has been consistent from Garcia through the Rehnquist Court and through to today, the Supreme Court has relied on those concepts to argue that cooperative federalism is okay. Well, now we've got an experience like the case of Texas shows that there's considerable reason to doubt that. And in fact, there was a symposium in the Yale Law Journal back in April on this topic that was very important, in my view, because these progressive law professors in the Yale symposium categorically rejected Wexler's theory of process federalism. They were more than willing to admit that the federal government, federal and state governments, are now more integrated than separate as a result of these cooperative federalism programs. They are willing to admit that the federal government, in effect, has achieved control over many state agencies and many state policies through these cooperative federalism programs. And they argue that it's a great thing because it leads to a more unified national polity, better national policymaking, and so forth. So the great opportunity that I see in the doctrine that they laid out is that the Supreme Court can agree with the first of their propositions without agreeing to the second one, which is to say that the Supreme Court now can take note that nobody on the left or right really takes its pronouncements on federalism seriously anymore, and progressives and conservatives now agree that it's resulting in a vast federal takeover of the states. And I think from there, the Supreme Court will have a much harder time agreeing with the National Federalist School of the Yale Symposium that it's a good thing. I don't think that the Supreme Court will ever rule that a federal takeover of the states is permissible given the structure of our Constitution. So I think it's fair to say that the case of Texas, Texas' struggle against EPA's greenhouse gas regulations, shows that the Supreme Court's theory is incorrect, that the states are not protected by the political process from abuses of the federal government's vastly greater bargaining power in its cooperative relation to the states. I've argued at the Texas Public Policy Foundation that one thing the states can do about this is to just let Washington do all of this stuff itself. For the states to say to Washington, look, if you want to regulate an area of something, you've got the supremacy clause. The commerce power says you can regulate everything under the sun. You do it. Don't rope us into implementing your regulations, because we realize now that on both sides of the cooperative federalism game, what the federal government is able to accomplish through the states is to regulate many more things than it would be able to do if it was confined to its own resources. In the APA context, for example, Congress telling EPA that it has to implement all this stuff itself might send EPA back to the House of Representatives for more hiring authority, which the House of Representatives might be more than willing to deny to EPA. But that still doesn't protect the states from the kinds of abuses that we see today. And I think where I'm interested to hear Dr. Michael Greaves' thoughts is on this question. I think the EPA case, the case of Texas versus EPA, shows Karl Popper might have said that it's the case that falsifies the Supreme Court's theory. What we've seen here in the EPA saga that Chairman Shaw just described is a phenomenon that the Supreme Court's theory of cooperative federalism does not explain, and that is arguably incompatible with that theory, and that arguably falsifies that theory. And so with that, I turn it over to Dr. Greva to suggest what the Supreme Court should be doing. And thank you very much.
Mario, thank you very much. I don't know exactly what the Supreme Court ought to be doing. My task here, as I understand it, is to sort of supply some sort of broader context for the debate. And to that end, I'll make sort of 3 points or suggestions. One is institutional. The second is constitutional, which is where Mario just ended. And third is sort of a political and ideological point. Here's the institutional point, which is that in all of these fights over this or that EPA regulation, and there have been many of them, global warming, in the context of global warming and beyond, what is at stake is sort of a general model of how federalism ought to work. And the general intuition ever since the New Deal, as Mario mentioned, has been, look, most of our problems, from the environment to healthcare to welfare to whatever, have national and local aspects. And so the idea that we should try to separate those institutionally is insane. Instead, governments should cooperate. And what you're witnessing now is the collapse of that consensus. Well, cooperate on what terms? Reasonable as it sounds to say, well, let governments cooperate, there are two huge risks. One is the risk of redistribution among states, and the second one is the risk of collusion among states, vertically as well as horizontally. And there's no better example of this than the Clean Air Act itself. It sounds, well, air pollution is national, and so therefore there has to be a national solution. That's not actually true. The original Air Act was intended to combat local pollution, and in one place in particular, that was L.A. There was no need for national intervention except to make L.A. a little more capable of curing its own air pollution problems without the risk of you know, incurring gargantuan costs along the way. And so we redistributed the costs all across the country. And apropos collusion, there was always a risk that local air pollution or state environmental agencies would say to their own industries, look, you have to let us regulate, otherwise the feds will. That wouldn't happen in Texas, but it happened in a lot of other places. And so over the course of time, people have woken up to this, and what you're seeing now is sort of the crumbling of an entire system, of an entire model that you can't cure by means of saying, well, let the EPA be under Republican control and be a little more nice to the states. The entire model has crushed. What you're really faced with now, it seems to me, is sort of a choice between, look, do we want to let states be competitive and be on their own, or else do we want to lock them into this cooperative system you know, make it work one way or the other? That's a really fundamental choice, and I think that's what we're confronted with. The second point is the constitutional point. It's about the kind of federalism we want. Do we want states to be competitive and have their own local regulations, or do we want to lock them into this intergovernmental cartel? It's a constitutional point, but in a very funny way, as Mario sort of explained, this isn't really about first-order rules. You know, you can't stamp your foot and say, this is what the Commerce Clause says and this is what it doesn't say, and that's it. It's about constitutionally inferred doctrines and common law rules. To my mind, that's always been true. It's true of Marbury versus Madison. It's true of McCulloch versus Maryland. Those aren't really first-order constitutional decisions. They're constitutional common law decisions. And at some point, we have to grow up, and the big task at hand, which Mario invited, but which I'm not up to today, is to figure out what exactly are the doctrines going to be in this environment. And the third point is the political and the ideological point, which is Chairman Shaw is right. I mean, to an extent, this really is about the state of Texas and like-minded states like Oklahoma and a few others versus an unbelievably doctrinaire and overreaching federal government. But I don't think that is really all of it. If you could restore the Clean Air Act to its original pre-Obama configuration, I'm sure you'd still have problems. As I said earlier, I think the real task is to sort of rethink and reconfigure federalism itself. And that is a big, big internal conservative dispute and debate and agenda. Just to give you an example of this from completely outside the environmental context, Congressman Ryan has just proposed a big sort of plan to reconfigure welfare. And it's sort of a monument to cooperative federalism. What he says is that, well, states are very bad at collecting money for of constructing a social welfare net, and so let the feds do that because they're very good at that. On the other hand, the feds are very bad at configuring that system to local needs, and so that must be done by the states. And so therefore, cooperative federalism. The feds raise the money, and the states and localities get to spend it. And the first reaction out of the Heritage Foundation, for example, was absolutely not. We've tried that. It failed. That's a block grant model. Thank you. We have to rethink this and sort of have a more competitive model where the states raise their own money. I have my own intuitions about that. I've sort of articulated them. But my major point is it's very, very healthy to have that debate inside conservative circles. I don't really care what the Yale Law Journal and its writers have to say. There's a very active, energetic debate inside conservative libertarian circles how to reconfigure federalism for the 21st century. And this conversation is part of that, and that's why I'm happy to participate in it, and it's all to the good.
Well, thank you very much, one and all. We're going to get to the audience questions in just a minute. First, we're going to have I'm going to give the chairman a chance to respond. Before I do that, though, let me make a quick announcement about our upcoming schedule of Teleform conference calls. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., our call will be debating net neutrality and the FCC's authority to impose a net neutrality regime. On Wednesday, also at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we're going to be talking about the not-so-new phenomenon of flash trading and how the digital revolution has affected trading. And then on Friday, we'll be discussing Russia in the Ukraine. So that's a brief programming note on some of our upcoming efforts. With that, Chairman Shaw, you heard quite a bit after your opening remarks. I wonder if you want to, if you heard anything there you want to respond to.
Yes, thank you. There's a couple of key points that I think especially jumped out at me. Dr. Rivas' points, especially with regard to what would happen if you restored things, you know, if you could go back and pick your ideal times in the history of the Clean Air Act and start over there. And I think his point is especially powerful from the standpoint that it is my belief as well, is that if you went and restarted, you basically are at a different point along the path. But the way the system is set up, it inevitably leads much to where we are today, especially in light of the many, and maybe it's a cynical thought, but the many examples we see where federal programs do nothing but grow and justify themselves, and programs never go away. And while there were likely some very good ideas behind the Clean Air Act, and certainly there's some noble goals there, the process that's in place inevitably leads to a federal government looking to have more power and authority and being able to justify its existence and expand its domain. And inevitably we see that where we've witnessed much today, where even in the attempts that EPA makes, where they're somewhat required or feel obligated to do cost analysis, cost benefit analysis on the programs, we've gotten to a point that they have tortured those processes to the point that they can justify most any program. And I could go through some excruciating detail about the inaccurate assumptions that they use that effectively makes it to where you can pretty well justify any program if it meets certain criteria. And the key thing is there's the process inevitably leads to the EPA developing a process for promoting and or justifying the programs that will bend and weave to what the court's decisions are, but ultimately they're continuing to chip away at the state's authority until you get to the point where, as described, we're pretty much mandated to follow EPA's desires as they desire them, and we have certain small victories, but then it's a matter of time because the next iteration through, they've adjusted to that court's decision or to that effort to try to curtail their expansion. And so it's not just a matter of we need to restart and everything will be fine. There is a path that tends to lead to where we are today. And it's interesting that we even at this point, I will share with you, there are some of my colleagues in other states that probably not publicly, but I've certainly heard them in more private situations express that they desire, these being the state environmental regulators, that they appreciate and like EPA forcing them to do something because it basically, in my words, it helps them to not be the bad guys. It basically gives them the cover of the federal government is making us do this, which to me is a sad statement that, you know, if that's your view of the value of your state sovereignty, you're not likely to keep it long if it's prevalent throughout your state. Obviously, if it were easy and we were just going to rubber stamp what EPA mandates, you don't need me and you don't need other state regulators in place. You've effectively have a single state. And it's, I guess, the point being that the process, unless you have significant and substantial checks and balances in, seems to inevitably lead to where we're moving very quickly today. And that's just a general comment on that.
Can I just expound on that briefly? Because it's very difficult to folks who don't follow this systematically to appreciate the difficulty that the chairman finds us and others like him find themselves in, and to appreciate the courage with which he has propounded his position. The way the system is set up is, if you, state official, do not follow the EPA's commands, you are thereby destroying your own industry at home. And that's not something the Obama administration has done. That's the way the system is set up. It is really, really nasty, and that sort of highlights, you know, the point Mario tried to make, I think, which is, if that's your system to destroy American industry, let the feds do it on their own, except, it, I mean, instead of sort of putting state officials in a position where they basically have to do that. That's the nastiness of the system. And to repeat, that is not a product of the Obama administration, even though that administration has seized on the opportunity with reckless abandon. It's baked into the laws and into the cooperative federalist system we have. And it's for that reason that you really have to rethink the regulatory system and the constitutional rules that constrain it.
All right. Mario Loyola, you want to get in here before we turn to the audience?
Yeah, in just a couple of minutes. That's a great point to sort of round up our discussion here amongst the commentators. You know, the basic problem that we're looking at here really does result from the intermingling of state and federal regulatory and fiscal operations. One of the great insights from Michael Greif's fantastic book, The Upside Down Constitution, is that once you intermingle state and federal regulatory and fiscal operations, you get a host of structural problems, fiscal dysfunction, regulatory dysfunction, political problems, loss of accountability, a lot of things that you can't really fix. And so I think the insight, and it's an insight that a lot of conservatives still have not come to, is that the government, democracy in America cannot work unless you have some division between states and federal authority. And so I think that the principle that we see at play now, we've seen it in the Halbig decision, you have a problem that a lot of us recognize with the rise of the administrative state, which is that Congress has delegated far too much rulemaking authority to the executive branch. Well, that problem in the division of power and the separation of powers and the checks and balances is not only horizontal within the federal government. It's also a problem that's a vertical separation of powers problem. So I think that one insight that conservatives really have to focus on is the separation of powers between federal and state authority. And it's something that we need the courts to start looking at and for politicians to start looking at. One thing that we've been wrestling with since the New Deal is, well, if you have Wickard versus Filburn and the principle of aggregation and the limitless commerce clause, where are the limits on federal power? Well, one way to draw the limits on federal power is to trace the outer boundaries of the proper authority of states. And you can't do that as long as there is so much overlap. So I think one thing that I hope everyone goes home with is separation of feds and states. And with that, I'm looking forward to questions.
Very good. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple questions to get started, so let's take the first call.
Hi, this is Karen Lugo from Texas Public Policy Foundation. I have a question as to what states can do together. What you're describing, and certainly we have witnessed, is that one or two states acting alone, being defiant, saying this is where the line should be drawn, just attracts retribution. And certainly this may be built into the way the system works, but there has to be a line drawn. I mean, this Clean Power Plan has gone to the point where, as you read General Pruitt's alternative plan, describes the full supplanting of states. When you're thinking about the idea now of cap and trade, you look at California's equivalent of a $1 billion tax as they volunteered to go ahead and implement something like this. But just understanding Justice Scalia's remarks in the UARG opinion, where he says that the EPA cannot put a regulatory regime in place that's transformative and that is politically profound without congressional approval. But yet we know that the courts defer. They don't tend to want to undo something that's already in place. So before this is put in place, what can the states do together to refuse this?
Who wants to respond first?
This is Brian. I'll take a stab at it since I'm one of those states. You know, that's a question that I continue to struggle with and continue to work to try to find ways that help us to do exactly that. Part of what we're doing, and I hope it's going to be successful, is we're working more and more cooperatively with like-minded states to try to speak in a more unified voice. It's very challenging, though, and especially each rule has its own set of circumstances. And this, the greenhouse gas rule certainly has its great challenges because it works to the EPA's favor very well, that each state, being different, needs to have different types of approaches if they're going to achieve any goal. And that's beside the point whether or not we should be and how much effort we should be putting to reduce greenhouse gases, a totally different topic. But once you have an environmental goal in place, each state's needs and how much pain they're going to suffer by implementing EPA's goal is going to be different from state to state. And so there's already a natural pitting of states against one another. And so we're working very diligently to try to find partnering states and ensure that we don't unnecessarily provide the fodder for EPA to use to tear the states apart and to pit them against one another. But effective, going down the road to be effective, we have to focus on the principles and make sure that states are willing to take a principled stand, much as some of us did with regard to the initial greenhouse gas rule that arguably has had economic consequences in the short term. But I would argue that had we not taken those stands, that the state and the nation would have suffered even more. And so I guess to some extent we have to convince states that you may have to play defense more than you would like to, but that does take a lot of political courage oftentimes in tough economic times. It's difficult for states to make those decisions. I think we have to find ways to educate the public about the reality of what is occurring, and frankly, we need an awakening of people to realize that the state's authority is being disassembled and that those consequences are real, but it takes groups like this and a lot of talking in order to convince folks of that need.
Can I comment on this? This is, to my mind, the single most important question in American federalism and the single point that conservatives and libertarians have to rethink. There are situations in which a single state can make a difference by just saying no. I remember this very vividly in an earlier life. I used to work for a public interest law firm, and we litigated the constitutionality of the Violence Against Women Act, whether Congress could actually impose a civil remedy for certain crimes on states. And there was an amicus brief by 36 states that said, oh, of course Congress can do this. Please, federal government, come govern us because we are too sexist and retrograde to govern ourselves. And there was a brief by a single state, Alabama, penned by then Attorney General Bill Pryor, now Judge Pryor, that said, no, here's the federalism universe as it looks to us and as it looks in the Constitution. And that was hugely important in winning that particular case. The ordinary situation is not like that. The chairman is exactly right. The federal government is very, very adept at sort of peeling off one state after another and locking them into a coalition. What is now happening, mercifully, is that there's a block of states that absolutely refuses to go along with that strategy because the issues are, so as it were, existential. You can't bribe Texas into these schemes anymore because Texas knows that, well, we have a competitive business model, and if we allow ourselves to bribe it, to be bribed into these federal schemes, we're dead. It's a mistake to think of these issues as the states versus Washington. That is not what's going on. There are some states that are good, and there are some states that are bad. Okay? The entire global warming melee was brought on by states. The lawsuit that gave rise to all of this is called Massachusetts versus EPA. So there's a block of states, Massachusetts, New York, Illinois, California, that is in favor of federal regulation precisely because they want the federal government to regulate pro-competitive states into oblivion. And there's a block of states led by Texas that resists this, and you have to hope that those states, Texas, Oklahoma, to some extent, actually, my home state, Virginia, believe it or not, on many occasions, that hang together and say, absolutely not. And so the ordinary sort of intergovernmental organizations that purport to represent the states, the National Governors Association and the NAG, institutions like that are completely hopeless. What you have to create and what conservatives have to create and what Texas has to create is a cohesive block of pro-competitive states. It doesn't have to be a majority. It has to be about sort of one-fourth of all states, 16, 17, something like that. That's enough. On any of these issues, states that simply say no. And you see this in lots of policy areas where when that happens, as it has on the Medicaid piece of Obamacare, the exchange piece of Obamacare, certain environmental issues, when that happens, when so 16, 17 states say, no, you can't, you won't, the federal government is completely incapable of overcoming that resistance. The system is just not built for that purpose. And therein lies the hope for federalism. The chairman is right. That's hard work. It's sort of persuading people on issue after issue after issue. But I think that just watching this sort of from halfway the outside, we're in the process of creating those networks and the infrastructure that is up to that task. And I'm sort of totally hopeful on that score. But you're precisely right on what's the issue here, what's the difficulty.
Mario Loyola, anything on this point?
I can't add anything to the two great sets of comments we just heard. So,
Before we go on to our next caller, our first caller, Karen Lugo, mentioned Attorney General Scott Pruitt's plan. I want to make sure our audience knows it was the topic that we discussed at a recent luncheon that was video recorded, and the video is available on the Federalist Society's website. So feel free to track that down on our website if you'd like. With that, let's take another call.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that we have gotten to this position by the willingness of lawyers and their clients in such cases to accede to taking a minimalist or incremental approach to defending their positions. Lawyers will advise their clients, well, we can't take a firm, rigid, pure constitutional position that would overthrow 200 years of precedence. The courts won't allow that. But maybe we can get this little bit of improvement in your situation over what you would otherwise experience. And the clients buy into that. They make an economic decision. But I would suggest that perhaps the way to get out of it is for lawyers to start advising their clients, look, we can take an incremental approach. The way that, say, a Nazi prison guard might take to his supervisor who wants to burn all the prisoners alive, to say, no, that's too inhumane. At least for my block of prisoners, let me gas them instead. All right? But it's still it's still wrong. And the client, the customer, needs to be given the alternative of taking a pure, rigid, uncompromising position, regardless of the consequences to him or to the lawyer. The lawyer has to be willing to accept being hit with sanctions, with being disbarred, and maybe thrown in jail. But that's what we need to start doing. No compromise.
Who wants to respond? Okay.
Well, I have a few comments, I hope they'll be suitably circumspect. So the first point of this is that the analysis doesn't quite apply to cases in which states are clients, right? that's a little more complicated. The second thing is it doesn't really apply to cases where, let's be candid about this, the lawyers and the institutions that litigate these cases have their own strategy and then find the clients to match. These are not cases where somebody is trampled upon immediately and then says, you know, scorched earth or incremental, and the lawyer says, well, I'll do what you want. So that complicates the fact a little. What lurks behind the question, I think, is, are we better off with sort of scorched earth litigation and silver bullet attacks or incrementalism and at variance, I suspect, with the caller, I'm an incrementalist at heart. The environmental cases are sort of very good example of this. The UARC case, the recent Clean Air case, I think is a very good example. It looks like a loss to us, but at the end of the day, if you look at what the EPA is now actually allowed to do, it ain't much. All of that is in the weeds. It's very hard to explain, and it'll be from here on out, it'll be, you know, a cloud of dust to anyone who doesn't follow these kinds of things, but it has real impact. And by the same token, the healthcare litigation is exactly the same. The frontal assault on Obamacare was, well, kind of mixed. And then comes this Halvick dispute, which is about some obscure IRS regulation under Section 36B of the Act that nobody comprehends unless you've scoured the whole thing the up and down. But that may bring the whole thing to a fall. Whether you like it or not, you know, in a modern sort of regulatory state and under which we live, most things will be incremental. Most things will be, you know, a game of inches. That doesn't mean you have to surrender your principles. You have to articulate them. You have to articulate them forcefully. I don't think anybody can blame, you know, Mario or the chairman for, you know, holding back anything. It's just that they insist on sort of what is helpful and productive and useful here and now, and I'm in favor of every small step that can usefully be taken.
Chairman or Mario Loyola, do you want to add to that at all?
This is Brian Shaw. I guess I would like to sort of weigh in. You know, one of the greater frustrations I've felt in my time at the Commission on Environmental Quality here in Texas has to do with some of those lawsuits and just the very nature of what I was speaking about. We were talking about earlier the need to have states join together. By that very nature, when you have a number of parties that are parties to a lawsuit, the frustration that I've had is oftentimes those issues that are nearest and dearest to my heart, which are often those that are scientific or engineering related and or that are so practical in nature, tend to not be the ones that ultimately the lawyers think have the greatest chance of having success. And certainly those issues that are important to Texas are going to be different to other states potentially. And so that process of litigating oftentimes becomes very I'm very removed from some of the decisions that are there, and I can see how it would be very problematic to be able to take those bold stands. Not that we don't share those frustrations when we see that incremental degradation of the process and of the constitutional protections that we have, but I don't know of an easy way around that. So I guess just wanted to share those frustrations that we see as we try to find ways to push back and sometimes wonder if you're taking two steps forward and one back, or if you're taking two back and one forward.
We've got about 10 minutes left, two questions pending at this point, so let's try and get to these final two questions.
Hi, this is Dawn Dodge. I have a question about, someone mentioned earlier about reconstructing federalism, or do you have any thoughts or ideas or solutions on how to do that?
Well, I'll jump in. I think that was Professor Grieva who talked about that. But I mean, one suggestion that I have made is just to start getting consensus, at least amongst ourselves in this part of the conversation, that state and fiscal, federal and regulatory operations need to be kept separate. I mean, Governor Jindal came out with this great national health care plan in the last year. It has many laudable aspects. I was reading through the plan, and my jaw dropped when I saw a proposal for a new $100 billion over 10 years federal conditional grant program. I mean, Louisiana was a party to the lawsuit against Obamacare that said that these programs are coercive. So if we can't get agreement amongst ourselves on this basic principle, we've really got a long ways to go. I mean, my background is as much international relations as constitutional law. I would love to see a summit of, 20 governors, 16, 17 was the number that Professor Grieva put, 20 governors, 25 governors get together, gather in Austin or wherever, and issue a simple one-page set of a communique, if you like, of points declaring a unified opposition to cooperative federalism and explaining in simple principles that everyone can understand what the dangers of cooperative federalism are.
Hmm. Other responses?
There isn't a sort of coherent, overall program. What there is, I think, is emerging, sort of an overarching theoretical framework, and that theoretical framework is competition among states. That's what we're in favor of, and cooperation is, or collusion is, what we're against. That doesn't translate into something that you can distill into a six-point program. It's an in-front war, and it plays out in healthcare and the environment and labor policy and virtually anything and everything that you can think of. So that's, hard work and piecemeal work, and it's a matter of policy proposals. And Mario just mentioned, and as I mentioned earlier, some proposals in conservative circles actually go in the opposite direction. That's true of Governor Jindal's proposal. That's true of the Ryan proposal that I alluded to earlier. So this is an active, vibrant debate. It's not something where, anybody can say, fine, now we have a party program. But the debate itself is huge, huge, huge progress over anything that I have seen over the past 30 years in American politics and conservative politics in particular. And so I'm cautiously optimistic.
Chairman Shaw, a comment here?
I think it's been covered. I guess the one thing I would say is I don't have the answers, but I have a desire that we find those answers, and I hope to be a part of helping to move forward and making progress toward the better solutions.
Let's take one more question now.
Hi, this is Tony Cotto with the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. We are the organization that sort of tries to get all the state insurance regulators on the same page. And it's been our experience that when the federal government is supposed to consult and coordinate with us, you know, often it feels like they're checking the box. They say, we heard you, now we're going to ignore you. So I'd like to get the panel's thoughts on that experience and sort of the, also the question of, you know, it feels like it's really the state legislature's powers that are being usurped all the time. So wouldn't it be a good idea, in addition to the courts, that we really start fighting this battle in the state legislatures? I'd be curious to hear the panel's thoughts.
Who wants to take the first shot at that one?
Well, I hate to be keep jumping in, but I will. I think that a couple of points you made there are a couple of points that are of interest from my perspective is that clearly the EPA asks for comments or takes the comments, checks the box, and ignores. They've progressed beyond that, unfortunately. If you look at this latest installment with regard to greenhouse gas regulations on existing power plants, EPA went through what was one of the most rigorous outreaches for comments from the states, getting input about the rule as best you could understand it before seeing it. And one of the things I continue to caution my colleagues, as well as purport to EPA that it wasn't ask EPA that they not misconstrue that, was that the states that were demanding that as the Clean Air Act envisioned and required in the certain statute they were using, 111D, to authorize their rule, that they not view the states demanding that flexibility be a request but a demand, that we weren't asking for favors. We were basically showing and wanting to make sure the EPA understood that we were already granted flexibility if they were going to use that rule to implement. What they did is exactly what I was concerned they would do is they, after taking extensive comments, they used that to justify a drastic expansion of any previous use of the 111D provision in that not only did they look at addressing what was determined to be what's called best system of environmental reduction, the standard they'd have to use to determine what levels they could require to be implemented, but instead they actually uttered the statement that because the states requested and asked for flexibility and being able to implement this rule beyond just making changes to the generating facility, but also states wanted to get credit for other programs they had, other ways they could creatively reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases, that EPA felt obligated to consider those other flexible options and add those to the required reductions. So they basically took what the states asked and demanded and turned around and said, you ask us to give you flexibility, we're going to give you flexibility, but ultimately it actually resulted in the standard for existing sources to be more stringent than the standards you would have to build a new source based on the process they use to turn the state's recommendations on its ear and uses against the state. So that process is continuing to evolve into a way that is even more damaging than in the past. So I'll let others comment about the state legislature aspect of that, but certainly the EPA has become very adept at seeking comment, but then ignoring and or using that comment for their own purposes.
I agree with the chairman that 111D will be ground zero in future years. My general comment is that, look, I think it's very, very hard to sort of generalize over policy areas and across states, right? So the environmental field is one. The insurance field is another, which is sort of complicated and complexified by a very unique federal overlay and system, the McCarran-Ferguson Act. There are situations in which state legislatures are sort of very much pitted against their executives, and the executives don't really want to cooperate with the feds, but the state legislatures want to because they want the money. Medicaid is an example. So I think a whole lot in these areas depends on the particular scheme, the particular regulatory form of cooperative federalism. That's one of the challenges, to sort of disentangle the threads here and to respond to the challenges as they arise and as they exist in any particular policy area.
Mario Loyal, if you'd like, the final word is yours.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and thank you to the, all the participants and speakers on this call. I just want to say, in closing, that my heart goes out to the last questioner, because if there's one group of state officials that's been abused by the federal government here over in the last years and decades, it's the state insurance regulators, and you know, the ground for them to be able to meet their constituents' preferences. The way that federalism was supposed to work has been almost completely eliminated. One of the purposes of Obamacare, of course, is to establish a nationally standardized series of insurance products. And so that's one of the most egregious examples that we've seen of the federal government really deputizing state agencies into the service of federal policy and turning them into basically field offices of the federal government. And so I think what we need there is an effort by the federal courts and in Congress to establish an umbrella, a kind of protective cover for the state legislatures to get back into the business of interstate regulatory competition. And one of the ways that they can do that is reestablishing the scope for state regulation of their own insurance products. If you remember, very few people remember the heroically quixotic effort of Mitch McConnell and others when Obamacare was being debated to offer a Republican alternative to the health care reform. Well, if you remember back to that bill, which was, I think, about 300 pages long, about 150 pages of it was a single section that had to do with the establishment of insurance sales across state lines. That's a fantastically complicated issue, as you would see if you perused the bill that was offered back in 2009-2010. But that's the kind of thing that we need to start looking for, is for states to show up in Congress and say, let us regulate this area and compete with each other in the regulations that we offer our citizens. And I guess that's about all I have to say for this hour.
Well, we are beyond the hour, as it happens. I want to give my thanks to Professor Michael Greva, Mario Loyola, and Chairman Brian Shaw for your excellent insights. There's more to be said on this topic for certain. We'll probably revisit it in the not-too-distant future. To our audience, thank you also for dialing in, and thank you for your questions and your participation. A reminder that tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, our teleforum will be looking at the FCC's authority to impose a net neutrality regime. But until that next teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.